Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight. I am very honored to have in studio Steve Vai. Steve, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. Very nice to be here. It's a pleasure.
I have my guest host tonight is, and helped me a lot put this show together, J.P. Durand. Another great person that helped me put this thing together, Michelle Caravello. And Lisa Carbe. I got everybody here. And Lance Allen is taking pictures while we're doing stuff. And I want to really thank Jim Crockett for putting us together. He was the guy that really got this whole thing together. He's a great guy, and yeah, I'm just really excited about the show. Anyway, before I start bombarding him with questions, I'm going to play a clip. It's called "Whispering a Prayer," and it was, I think, this version is from the Live in the Ultra World. And I think the one that was nominated was from the G3 concert, if I'm correct. It was another version, or was it this one?
I think it was this one.
Okay. Well, it's killer.
I should know these things.
It's a really killer song, but it just goes to explain where I think Steve is just really taking guitar, and he pioneers and goes into different directions and makes the instrument. It's unique what he does in terms of the voicing. And this little clip that I'm playing, and at the end of the show, I'm going to play a little more of this song because it's just a killer song. And it just shows you it's uniquely Steve, but it's just really, all I can say is it's incredibly cool. So anyway, here's Whispering a Prayer. Thank you. is a beautiful piece.
Thank you.
It's really good. Now, that isn't the first time you've won a Grammy. You actually won a Grammy in 1994 for Sofa, which was part of Frank Zappa's.
Yeah. Actually, I didn't win a Grammy for that one.
Oh, that was just not...
Yeah, I've actually have 15 nominations, and I've won 3 Grammys.
That is very, very cool.
Very nice.
Now, you that first one was for Sofa with Frank Zappa.
Yeah.
Now, I have one question with Zappa was, because you had started out, as I understand, you were doing transcriptions and stuff, and then you ended up playing with him, and you were the guy that played all the difficult parts on it. But what was the biggest thing that you learned from Zappa?
Well, Frank was an extraordinary guy, you know, and I was 18 when I started working for him doing the transcriptions. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine how impressionable, especially since I was enamored with his music. So he wanted to try me out for the band, but when he found out I was 18, he said, forget it. But on my day after my 20th birthday, I moved out to California, and I just started going up to the house, and next thing you know, I was recording, and then I was in rehearsals. And the thing that was so amazing about Frank was, you know, it was so exciting to watch him work, because Frank was completely present. You know, he was completely in the moment of everything he was doing, and he would get an idea and he would just do it. He never made excuses, and he never expected anybody to do it for him. Mm-hmm. He just got a great idea and he got excited about it, and then he just did it. And that was that had a big impact on me, because 6 years of watching him do that and then going out and being an independent musician, I just thought, well, this is what you do. You get an idea and you just go do it. And if you want to do it here and it's not working there, you go around the corner. Oh, it's something even better, you know. And then everything just always fell into place for me. It was kind of...
Well, I remember, I was telling Jim Crockett when he was on the show before, I said, I remember the transcriptions. You used to do transcriptions, and they were really cool. I'm like, yeah, that's exactly how I was like, you know, because, I mean, we all bought sheet music before, and if you ever, it never was right, you know, like the Beatle books, the chords were way off, you know. But, you know, his stuff was just right on the money. It was it was pretty close. I mean,
it was bizarre what I was doing. It wasn't just... I don't know why, but when I was always very interested in composition when I was younger. I mean, you know, music, when it's written, it looks like art.
Yeah.
You know, it's beautiful. It's like a language, like a secret language. So I wanted to know everything about it. And I just studied it and studied it, and I would just doodle notes. And when I was in college, I started transcribing. And that's when you listen to stuff and you write it down. But most stuff is pretty... relatively easy, because it's straight eighth notes or quarter notes or melodies. Yeah. But Frank's stuff, I mean, it was guitar solos and drum parts and orchestra things and full band.
Was he a big influence in how you orchestrated later on? Did you learn a lot from him in terms of orchestration, or was it just...
Well, you didn't learn from Frank orchestrating because he wouldn't sit and teach you things. You know what I mean? He just went into his room and he composed, and then he'd come out and you'd listen to it when it was done, after he got it recorded or whatever. So in regards to that, I was listening to various kinds of composers. But the thing that I did get to see Frank do that was remarkable was when he would orchestrate for the band. I mean, it was like any means necessary. He would play something for you, and then he'd say, play that back, you know, or he'd sing something to you, and he'd say, play that now, and then he'd give these, or he'd bring a piece of music in, and he'd put this music here, and constantly editing and changing, and very in tune with the point he was trying to get across.
Right.
You know, the music was, he would shape the music to sound like, I remember this one thing we were doing where he told the keyboard player to play a series of descending diminished chords like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood from Hell. You know? And this was a constant, and like, I know what that sounds like, you know?
The secret language of musicians, that's for sure.
The secret language of Frank.
Years ago, I heard a story from one of the session guys. We used to do, when I was at SC, we studied electronic music at Paul Beaver's old studio.
Okay.
And a couple of session guys were in there, and they were telling me they had done a gig with Frank. And I forget who the player was. It was a vibe player. And he had written this thing out, and it was just notes everywhere.
Headman?
It might have been. That's what. The person was working through the part and like that. And he came up to me and goes, no, it's like this. And he played it.
Yeah. Ed, if it was Ed, Ed was is a remarkable, remarkable musician.
He could all of the guys that he was using at that at that time, he was using some top people. But I mean, the guy, he knew what he wanted. He was right, right there.
He knew exactly what he wanted.
Now, you studied at Berklee, right?
Mm-hmm.
And did you study composition? Did you study orchestration there?
Yeah, to a degree. You know, first you go through the traditional understanding classical composition and all of its rules, and then you go to break it. But I was already composing, you know, like I wrote my first orchestra score in ninth grade in high school.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and tried to get the high school band to play it. It was an abysmal disaster. I still have a scar on my finger from Ryan.
That's pretty cool, though. No, the and I'm going to play a couple of clips from some of the stuff from String Theories, which has you orchestrating. But I'm not going to – I'm going to warn you. This is not guitar stuff. I'm going to show it because there's – and I have a question.
You're going to play my orchestra music on the radio?
Whoa. Of course. Actually, I mean –
you might get in trouble for that.
But anyway, this one is – this is kind of interesting because you're doing some really interesting stuff on this. It's very – there's a lot of syncopation, a lot of percussiveness to it. This is a clip for the love of God. So okay. Let me play that. Oh. Now that's a clip that you're going to play when you're going to do a quiz like, who's that composer? It's really beautiful stuff.
Look,
that's not the clip I meant to play that has all the percussive stuff. I know that's the wrong. But anyway, the reason I wanted to play that is the idioms for the way the woodwinds are phrasing and stuff. It's right on the money. Yeah. And what I wanted to ask you was, when you write, do you write on the keyboard or do you write on the guitar or you just write on paper?
All three.
Okay.
Sometimes I'll write on an airplane. You know, I'll sketch some things, or sometimes I'll plunk out stuff on a keyboard. I can't really play the keyboard, but I don't need to compose really. I just need to hear,
because you're getting some of the phrasing of the instruments. They're a lot of guitar players will write like a guitar part for a flute or write a guitar part, and it's cool, it's an interesting sound, but the way that flute's playing is killer. It's right on the money.
Well, what's really wonderful about composing is there's so many colors and there's so many tools. I mean, just one note, if you know how to decorate it with the right ornamentation, like staccatos or tenutos, or you can make it sound like anything, mm-hmm. you know, with certain phrasing. And you just need to know a little bit. There's a couple of really good books. And you just need to know a little bit about how certain instruments phrase and finger and stuff like that. And then you put all that away, and you can open up your imagination, and you hear stuff in your head, and it's just such a pleasure to just la 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 la.
But I mean, I'll play another clip in a minute. That's where the piano phrasing is just right on. I mean, the little ornamentations and stuff is very pianoish. It's not something you would as a guitar player, it would, you know, you got it, you nailed it. But I want to ask you a question. I'm going to flip it around. When you think melodically, when you're listening to stuff and you're improvising and stuff, do you listen a lot to other instruments or guitar? I mean, like, I know a lot of jazz guys listen to saxophone, and a lot of their leads and stuff are based on saxophone. Do you base your stuff on other instruments? You listen to violin, flute? I mean, how do you?
No. Not okay. at all. Well, actually, I should say, at times when I'm looking for inspiration, I'll go and listen to an sort of an exotic instrument.
Okay.
There was this one Indian mandolin player. His name is Srinivas. Stunning player. I mean, what he was doing, the techniques, I hear them, and I say, okay, I see how I can, you know, phrase that. Or I'll listen to bagpipes or something, mm-hmm. you know. Or you can listen to even odd cultural music from another country, and it can give you ideas if you're open-minded to it.
Yeah. I've always tried to emulate Ilian pipes on guitar. I'm just not fast enough.
You're going to hurt yourself.
Yeah. But it's it's interesting that let me ask you too, as an orchestrator and composer, who's an influence classically for you?
Oh boy. Well, when I was young, my parents probably one of my biggest influences was when I was young, my parents were listening to West Side Story.
Oh, okay.
So Leonard Bernstein was really big. And then I got into, I wasn't really always a big fan of classical music, you know, the classical period, Baroque, Renaissance, stuff like that. I was more into contemporary artists like Giorgi Ligeti or Stravinsky, of course, probably one of my favorite. But then some romantic stuff like Mahler and I like Luciano Berio. Absolutely out of his mind. Beautiful, beautiful. Xenakis. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this really great composer that lives in New York, and he's from Finland, and his name is Mengus Lindberg. And he is, when I hear his music, mm-hmm. I don't hear anything like it. It's so rare that you can hear music that doesn't, you don't know where the influences are coming from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Frank's synclavier music is like that. Mm-hmm. There's no place where you can go, oh, that sounds like so-and-so, you know,
yeah.
Nothing,
mm-hmm.
nothing completely unique. It's ahead of its time.
Yeah. Now, did you ever listen to some of like the jazz arrangement? Were you into jazz a lot in college?
Yeah. I was into jazz only in that it was stimulating because intellectually, because it's a lot of shapes and a lot of theory behind it. But to be a really great jazz player, no, that's not my thing because that takes a
but I mean, like
brain muscle from hell, you know?
In terms of the composition and stuff, like, I mean, for me, a couple of my friends turned me on to, like, Don Sobieski, where he was doing, like, he did the Firebird as a jazz thing.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And they were doing some cool stuff like that, you know, or Bob James, another big, I was just curious if you were...
I was more into big band stuff, like Sinatra and Buddy Rich. I had all Buddy Rich's record. He had the tightest big band of anybody.
Yeah.
And you know what was one of the greatest things about going to music school was at the time they had at Berkeley this library that had everything in it. It was like the first time I heard all the Beatles music or all of Stravinsky or all of, you know, anything. That's where I lived, in the library mm-hmm. at Berkeley.
No, I hear you. At SC, I used to go there all the time.
Yeah.
I think I wore out about 50 of their records. That's another story. Anyway, I'm going to play the clip that I was originally going to play about. It's another orchestral piece. I think you're playing guitar on this, and it's interesting because they answer back and forth. And it's interesting how you scored the orchestra. They're kind of doing what you're doing that you traditionally do on a guitar.
Kill the guy with the ball, right?
Kill the guy with the ball, which is a killer name anyway. Just that name of the song, that's it. So let me play this clip real quick.
Thank you.
One thing I have to ask you yeah. is you have to publish that orchestra score. I want to know how you wrote that. It's like, how do you?
Well, that I cheated on. The rest of the piece is scored. But that one, I just, it's written in the part. It says, first, you know, first it's the strings
right.
that come out, and I play something, and then they have to mimic what I play.
Oh, so they were totally improvised.
They were listening to me.
Right.
And then the next time, the second time, they have to keep repeating it, and then I build it by doing it with the horns, and then with yeah. the woodwinds, and then with the percussion. So, I mean, I could easily write that, score that. That's easy. But then it would be the same all the time.
Right.
And I like that section to be...
Yeah, kind of no, but it was interesting where he does the dive on the whammy bar and the brass does.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you don't want to step in that.
Yeah, yeah.
That was hip. I thought that was really good. But that I just thought that was just great mm-hmm. how you were able to get them to mimic that. That's that must have been a very cool orchestra.
It was really, really well. That was a great orchestra. Really, that was the Metropole Orchestra in Holland. There, a lot of young people. So they're capable of doing that, you know, and they're capable of improvising in parts. On my last tour, I played with four different orchestras. And some of the symphonies, you know, they're a little uncomfortable doing that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
They won't
yeah.
do it.
Yeah.
Some of them are very, very, very strict. I know that.
It looks yeah. like your experience has mirrored some of Zappa's with his up and downs with the different orchestras. So that continued as well. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, I had great experiences with them all. Mm-hmm. Except that one in Romania, a couple of guys in that. Well, anyway, but they're all really nice. But it's the you know, just the protocol. If you're in an orchestra and you've been in the seat, the first seat for the flute for 25 years, and you know, orchestras, you're always dressed up, and you get some crazy guy with long hair and a whammy bar going, "Hey, play this." You know, they're just like, huh? You know?
Can you please write that for me?
Yes, can you write that?
Yeah.
Yes, no, I can.
And you have to remember, there's the concertmaster that usually runs the orchestra, the first violinist.
Yeah.
And there's a whole protocol. I remember that. There's at SC, with a lot of the players, there's a whole...
The conductor is the maestro. Yeah. You know, in 2 weeks, I'm going to be in Rio, mm-hmm. at Rock in Rio.
Oh, cool.
With a 60-piece orchestra.
Oh,
and from Florianopolis, and we're going to be opening the show with that piece.
Yeah. Well, are you guys going to be taping that?
I don't know if they're planning on doing that, but I got to tell you one funny thing about orchestras, since you seem so interested. So over the last few years, I played with four or five different orchestras, and before that, you know, a bunch. And it was so funny what I noticed when I would go and I'd be in these cities and I'd give them the music. And they would be playing the music, the same music, in each city. I was in Poland. I played with the Warsaw Orchestra. They played a whole night of my music. And in Russia with the Moscow Symphony, in Kaluga, and then Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And it always sounded a little different, the melodies. And I couldn't quite figure out what it was. And I'm listening, what is it? And then I realized that it has an accent to it. You know, like mm-hmm, if you talk mm-hmm. to some, like if you talk to somebody that's Dutch, you hear the accent in their voice. Well, the musicians around the world, there's the accent in the music that I hear.
Mm-hmm.
It's really
totally
interesting.
Totally makes sense, actually.
Yeah,
wow.
I'm like, it's the same notes, but it sounds Romanian.
Interpreted differently.
Yeah.
With some of those orchestras that you're using, like in Romania and stuff, were you using their traditional orchestra? Because there are orchestras now that are doing film scores, so they're exposed to a lot more contemporary stuff, where they seem like they were all pretty hip now. I think it's changed now than from before, like when we were in school. Orchestras were very strict.
Well, you know, the European orchestras were really great. They weren't quite as strict when I was playing in with American orchestras. They're a little more rigid,
mm-hmm.
actually.
Mm-hmm.
Or Tokyo, very rigid. but they play...
They will play anything.
There's some orchestras they won't play if they don't like the music, you know. But I was lucky. They were wonderful.
No, the album, the String Theories Part 1 and 2, definitely check it out, because there's you playing with the orchestra, and then there's some pieces that are just orchestra pieces on there.
Yeah, it's a double CD, cool. And the first CD is songs with me playing with the orchestra, and then the second one is compositions with that. I probably have about four or five recorded symphonies on the shelf that I have to mix.
They're coming out.
Oh, it's a huge job, though.
So. Yeah, no, I understand. But, I mean, they're definitely coming, because it's really cool stuff. I mean, what you're doing orchestration-wise and just the compositions that you're doing instrumentally are very, very cool.
Thanks.
Very, very
You get useful. A kick out of the last one I did. I wrote, I needed 17 minutes of music, and I didn't have much time to write it, only about 3 months, so I needed a guitar part that was really easy, and I wanted it to be easy for the orchestra. I came up with this idea to play this piece of music where I held one note for 17 minutes.
Whoa.
And I stood there as still as I could. And the orchestra came in, and, you know, that one note takes on all these different colors, you know, and sometimes it was raging intense, and sometimes it was really very, very delicate. And the looks on the people's faces were surprising. But it was really great. It was very, very successful.
That's cool. Yeah. I got to hear that. That's going to be...
It's amazing the body of work that you've been able to develop and the direction that I'd wanted to ask you a little bit about. Everything that you have done, from my perspective anyway, is a result of really intense focus and discipline. And I remember years ago at an interview, like, well, I went to Berkeley, but my timing was out to lunch. I always remember that phrase was like, Steve I doesn't sound to me like somebody whose timing is out to lunch. How did he improve that? And then you said you were listening to tapes at night to get the solos. And it's all a matter of discipline in life, in practice, in food, and, you know, the way you conduct your life. You've been running bands. You've been doing compositions. I wanted you to talk a little bit about the role or the notion of discipline in your practice, in your band leading, do you think people are born with it, can be acquired? And what tips, since you are, for years you've been writing columns and you've been talking about education, been doing all these things, talk a little bit about the role of discipline in your music, because it's the arc that kind of unifies everything you've done.
Yeah. Well, I think in this case, discipline is being disguised as enthusiasm, because discipline conjures... this state of mind that's very intense, very focused, very, I don't care what's going on. It's like a myopic kind of a, you know, intense. Mm-hmm. And although there was some of that, I'm pretty undisciplined, actually. It was, I always moved within the realm of enthusiasm. It was almost like selfish. It was just like, you get an idea for something, and it excites you, and that's all you need. And then the focus, and this is true for anybody. If you find that thing in your life that you, when you're doing it, there's no pressure, there's no fear of the future in it, there's no concerns about being judged by it, there's no time stands still when you're doing it. You know, it's just like an opening into presence, and it's just this feeling of joy. The discipline is in stopping. That was the hardest thing for me, you know, when I was younger. I just wanted to play, because every time I would come up with a new riff, it was like every day was Christmas. You know, it was just that, it was so exciting, and everything else was just not as interesting. So that's what it looks like, discipline. But I loved keeping lists of what I was going to practice, because I knew that if I started here, there's no way I wasn't going to end up there. How could you not do it if you don't quit? You can't not do it. And that, when I discovered that, it was like I could do anything. And that's basically how I, of course, not anything, but anything that I wanted to, that I put my mind on. And that's how I got the gig with Frank. He would give me this impossible music, and to me it was like, oh boy, here goes, you know. And if you started really, really slow and perfect, how could you fail if you just stay with it? So my advice always to young musicians is, first of all, don't worry about anything, because that's what's going to screw you up. You know, that always has a tendency to rob you of your enthusiasm, worry, you know. And if, just try to find some peace And then ask yourself, what is it that you really like? And also passion, you know. The passion is kind of, it's a scary word for some young people because they're afraid that they haven't found their passion. What is my passion? Mm-hmm. Why am I not like these people that are so intensely engrossed in what they're doing with this fiery passion and fierce focus and discipline, you know? And they may not have that. And then they think, well, what's wrong with me? But really, passion is kind of like, and you all know it. It's just the excitement. It's a very subtle spark of something at first. It's kind of like an analogy that I make is like if you smell a beautiful flower when you first smell it, there's that moment of just intoxication. That's a bit of an analogy of the feeling of enthusiasm when you come up with an idea for something, and then it's just you start following it, and then you just start doing it little by little, step by step. The thing that will cut right at the root of that is fear of failing at it, fear of being judged at it. Mm-hmm. So these things weren't really there when I was young. Matter of fact, I had no intentions of being famous or... I was scared to death of the idea. I think when I was a kid, somebody said, famous people are crazy. Or if you become famous, you go insane.
Yeah.
You know? And you know what?
Right.
Some people...
How do you... it's really cool to think that you could stay in a state of sustained joy or enthusiasm for that time and use that as a creative base to work from. But there's also... There's the band, there's the management, there's the tour bus, there's getting to the plane. And you talk a little bit about transcendental meditation on your site. What do you, are there any things that you employ or use when real life gets in the way? Like, you know, sorry to ring, but like a tour bus burning, you know, in the middle mm-hmm. of wherever. How like John McLaughlin once said, I think of Miles Davis, you know, he's a great man, but he's just a man when he went into that retirement. You know, we all have to deal with that day-to-day thing. So how do you stay in that creative place but also deal with the day-to-day thing? You know?
Well, we all become time managers to a degree. Mm-hmm. You know, there are responsibilities that we all have, and the trick is to find the things you like about those things. So this wasn't the case for me when I was younger. I had a really hard time. You know, especially the tour with Frank. I was so young, and I didn't know how to handle myself on tour. The fear of becoming, even the idea of becoming famous, started to fulfill itself, and I started to have real anxiety and panic, and it drove me right into the ground. It almost killed me, but then it was very valuable too, because sometimes. And there's various kinds of suffering, you know. There's mental suffering and there's physical suffering. I experienced mental suffering when I was younger, but that's has great, great value because it pushes you to find something deeper. It has to, or you're just going to be miserable your whole life or die, you know. So I was really fortunate, and that's when I started to. You remember the Bodhi tree over here? Mm. Bodhi tree.
Yeah, we love it.
I mean, I discovered that in 1982.
It's a great place.
So I lived there, you know, and I started absorbing all of this stuff that really gave me a different perspective. And what I realized is there's always going to be things like you say. You know, there's things, especially in any business, we say the tour bus burning, blah, blah, blah. But really, this happens for all of us. And the what I practice is finding the solutions. I know that there's not only one solution, but there's multiple, many solutions. But if you're stuck in complaining about everything, then you're not going to see the solution. So it's odd, but even when weird things happen sometimes, I almost get excited because then I can find solutions. And when you're touring, I've been touring for 35 years. I've seen it all. You know,
yeah,
and,
yeah.
Well, I believe I have, and or a lot, I should say. But your perspectives change. And what I realize, I want to have a great time. I want to have a great time on tour. I want to have a great time with the musicians I play with. I want to have a great time with my kids. I just want to, you know, and that you're entirely responsible for that, nobody else, and it's based on the thoughts you choose to think.
Yeah. You had said that at the end of that tour, you went into a significant depression. Is it now a case that you will never need to visit that place again, or are you more at peace when darkness comes and you go, I have the tools to move through that, or do you just not happen to visit that by virtue of how you lead your life?
Well, that was a phase that I went through when I was young, right. 20, 21. And depression is different than being moody or bummed out. You know, depression is an odd kind of a black hole.
You went there.
I went deep. Mm. And it maybe there was things. I was a very intense young man, too. You know, I mean, anybody would practice 10, 12, you know, hours a day and just really intense. And there was a lot of, I don't know, there was things. They were in there. Maybe, I don't know, karma, whatever it is. But they came up. And when I was that young man, 20, 21, they pulled me down. So that was different than anything like just being in a bad mood. But no, that once I got out of that never, because I understood it. And I understood how, you know, the process of evolving out of it and the value of it. But when you're in it, you just think that you're the only one in the world. Especially back then, there weren't drugs, you know, they weren't prescribing drugs for that kind of thing. And but no, it was actually quite valuable to me. But once I got out of it, that was it. Never even closely went back.
When did you begin to feel like you've been doing columns and everything for a very long time? But when did you begin to feel education make a noise? All of these tremendous programs that you've started and different things that you've done. When did you feel like, or did you always want? I want to do an education. I want to do a column. I want to be able to support kids. I want to do the Vi Academy. Is that something that was always, God, I really want to do that? Or was it more like last 10, 20 years? How did that develop?
You know, it's so funny. I just think I lived a charmed life because anything I've even remotely wanted to do just flowed in. And it was just a reflection of just my enjoyment of playing the instrument. Everything came from that. Now, there were challenges, you know, like later on when you're touring and you're selling out arenas and you're making a lot of money and you're on the cover of all the magazines and everybody's telling you you're great. That has its challenges, you know. But I've always loved education. I started teaching guitar when I was younger, when I was in high school. I liked the process because when you teach, you learn, you know.
That's true. That's
it's so
true.
Great to learn when you teach. And I had a bit of a knack for it. So that, you know, being a guitar teacher blossomed into the something like the Vi Academy, which was a wonderful evolution, you know. And, you know, these days, these wonderful guitar camps are becoming pretty popular, and I've been invited to do them, you know, but I always was waiting for something special to come along in my head. And so I thought of themed camps, you know, and last year's camp was just so great. It was, I call it a camp, but it was like a, you know, Gideon Putnam Resort. And, you know, we were at, like, you know, in Vail this year, you know, it's like a 5-star
resort.
Vail. Yes, we're in Vail. And, and the first year was great. It was all about, you know, the things that most musicians are interested in knowing. How do I write songs? Where do I find the inspiration? How do I record them? How do I get my music out into the world? And how do I market it? And how do I go on tour? So I've been through so much of that. And I'll tell you, you know, the music business, I've always loved it. I think it's a great business. As a matter of fact, there's opportunities now for musicians, independent musicians, like there never was. This is the best time, I think, you know. But it's all based on how you look at it, how you approach it. So this camp that I did was quite valuable because it was comprehensive and intense. In 4 days, we did everything from songwriting seminars, and we wrote a song. I talked about inspiration. I had people come in talk about inspiration. I had professionals come in and teach people how to start their own publishing companies and register their songs, because it's something you have to know.
Absolutely.
Very simple to do. Seems very intimidating to a musician, but it's really stupid simple, and you have to do it to protect your intellectual property, because if you own this building we're in, that's your actual property. It's not, it's a song, you know, yeah. And they have to know how to protect it, you know, and I've been very good at that all through the years. And then we actually recorded the song. We have 155 guitar players on it. I showed people, we talked about mixing and about the stereo spectrum. And then I had people come in and talk about the music business and marketing, branding yourself, and then taking the song and putting it up on, starting your own account online and putting your music up digitally around the world in 10 minutes. You know, you can do that, and you collect all the money for it. You have to market it. I mean, it's work, but it's fun work, you know, if you enjoy it. So you just got to find the thing you enjoy about it, and there's never any work involved, and there's no discipline involved, you know.
Yeah. I have to say, you also kind of put your money where your mouth is with Favored Nations. I mean, that was tremendous to be able to not just have, you know, Steve Lukather, Larry Carlin, Aaron Johnson, all these people. You started that, I want to say, 8 years ago? Longer than that? Shorter than that?
20.
20.
Favored Nations is 20.
It's coming on 20.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So how do you see that as a label owner? That's a segue into, like, there's the social media. there's all these different revenue streams. There's iTunes. There's the, you know, Pandora. There's all these things. Where do you see it for yourself as an artist? Because you're a signed artist, is a different thing. Where do you see it for Favored Nations? Where does somebody like you, who's kind of not really getting insider information, but is at the leading cusp of generally the latest information on what's coming up, where do you see things going?
Well, one thing that's for sure, it's going someplace. You know, and it's always evolving. The music business, like any other business, the way that we record our music, the way that we manufacture it, distribute it, listen to it, buy it, it's all it's changed. And it's going to continue to change. It's very interesting that we always think that whatever technology we're in, we've arrived. But then somebody comes along and goes, oh, no, you haven't, you know. And
always evolving.
Always evolving, and it's lovely to watch. Now, what happens a lot of times is when you're a musician, you need to, but it's a good idea to keep your eye out on how things are evolving. When I started Favored Nations, we were one of the first independent music label to be up on iTunes. Mm-hmm. Imagine that, you know.
That's pretty fun.
And I like the business, and when I was young, I studied it, and I understood it. It's not that difficult. And I started my first label when I was 24, and I released Flexible.
That was Flexible?
Yeah. And I had crazy success with it, you know. And then it's a lot to run a label. So I did, you know, I joined with Relativity, then, which was Sony. And then I started Favored Nations. And basically, Favored Nations was for, you know, artists that already kind of knew what they were about. It wasn't about breaking artists at radio or anything like that. It was about people that had a vision and had a voice on their instrument and knew what they were doing. I just stood out of the way, you know, and I just created the infrastructure to get the music out there. But as the technology changed, it became a little more difficult to get into retail stores. They don't really exist.
That's so we what still, I was wondering. What,
the label still sells digitally all the time, you know. But
as catalog.
I had a wonderful... As catalog, yeah. And I might release a few things. I released my last studio record through Favored Nation because I was signed to Sony up until then. And then it did pretty well, so Sony signed me back. And it took a lot, but they offered me a deal I couldn't refuse. Crazy.
It would have at that point,
yeah,
I would imagine.
And you know what, though, I noticed also is I spent a lot of time on Favored Nations. And as much as I enjoyed it and as much as I loved working with artists, I got that from it. But then I realized there was a lot of my music that wasn't being made. So now the focus is back on writing and recording and touring.
Right on.
No, that's good. Now, speaking about the Academy, I wanted to ask you, the last one that you just did that just finished in August was all about the guitar,
all about
which
the,
was
how do you
really
like,
cool.
How do you like that, Jeff?
That's there are no coincidences.
That's right.
But what I thought was really cool about it was that you were talking, you know, obviously they went, there were classes and playing and stuff like that. But then you said that you wanted to get more into it. So you started talking about the woods, the necks, the construction, and all that. It was very – I thought that was kind of cool because you went into some stuff that I initially wouldn't think about. What I want to ask you, though, is what did you learn from that? After doing that, what did you come out of there that you didn't know?
Well, you'd be surprised how little I actually know of the guitar itself. You know, I can write all the notes to play it, but when it comes to the woods, when I'm designing an instrument, I'm very focused on it, and I do all my homework, and I research. But I don't know. Academics, they just elude me after a while. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like learning a language. I've tried to learn Italian so many times. It's just boom, right out. I can remember anything about the orchestra, but when it comes to remembering the neck dimension of that guitar, forget it. It's just totally boring to me.
Well, I know we used to know, like, we, for example, if we to get a certain sound, you know, alder body, maple neck, that kind of stuff too. And it was interesting that you guys probed that a little bit because the woods do make a difference.
Oh, big difference. They make a big difference, and we had some great people there. We had Paul from Paul Reed Smith, Paul Young, and Larry DiMarzio. I mean, mm-hmm. the guy that designed the first replacement pickup, and so many great people. We had a guitar made by Ibanez, and we videotaped it. Talk from their custom department, and you can see every aspect of the guitar was discussed. So, because so many people don't know, and when they go to buy a guitar, they don't know what they really want. And you're right, the kind of wood, the kind of pickups, the kind of wood that the neck is, the finish on the guitar, all these things have, you know, maybe a nuance of a effect, but they have an effect. And if you learning this, it gives you a better opportunity to pick out what you want when you go to a store. So it worked out really great.
No, I remember when I've said before, when I bought a lot of, when I had my guitars were like in the 70s, and a lot of the guitar companies weren't that great then. So we always modded our guitars because they weren't right, and we would fix them. And so that's where I got into it, where we would start getting into wood. But we noticed that, you know, this guy has a Strat, this guy has a Strat. They sound totally different. And your hands affect it a lot. But when I picked it up and played the two, they didn't sound right. So we and actually, which is really cool now with when you go to NAMM and stuff, it is down. They got it down to a science. They can tell you which woods and what pickups and the different types of, I mean, they got it down to the windings and stuff. Yeah. But I thought that was kind of cool because you need to know that. I mean, it's important, just like amps, speakers, tubes.
Yeah.
I mean, the difference between an EL34, a 6V6, or a 6L6, the tonal differences, and all of that stuff comes into play. I thought that was kind of cool that you were doing in the academy. Now, what's coming up for 2016? Have you guys decided what you're going to do?
For the academy, I have some ideas I'm hitting around. You know, we have guest clinicians that come in. This year we had Sonny Landreth and Eric Johnson. Mm-hmm. That was fantastic. So I'm thinking of doing something that's really focused on technique in the next, because I haven't done that. And a lot of people want to know that, you know. And but also there's – I have a tendency when I'm talking and when I'm doing things, like I go into these realms of esoteric stuff. You know, and when I do my classes, because I travel around and I do Alien Guitar Secrets master classes, which are basically me sitting and talking for 3 hours, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, I always felt that there's a lot of great ways that you can find academics about the instrument. You can learn scales and theory and all that stuff, and it's all good if you're interested. But what I've learned through the years is the most important thing about the progress of your playing is how you choose to think about it, you know. So I talk a lot about that in my, you know, master classes. Mm-hmm. So I thought about doing a class that goes very deep into that, finding your note, mm-hmm. you know, like really right. finding your own unique voice. And I've developed a lot of techniques to nurture that, to find it and nurture it if it's there.
Well, I want to mention, since you're talking about technique and stuff, I want to read a quote that's on your Make a Noise Foundation, which I think is very important, and it it deals with the whole educational process. And this is, I'm quoting right now, it has been proven that music and playing an instrument have positive effects not only on children but adults as well. Music educates the whole person as an integrated individual. It educates the mind, the senses, and the emotion. I form make a noise to ensure that those interested in music should not have to sacrifice their ability to develop important skills and express emotions due to limited financial resources. So basically the organization, which is makeanoise.org, so you guys know, is basically people that need, that don't have the money to buy instruments. But what was important that drew me in, and my guest next week, we're going to be talking about this too, is that the skill sets that you learn in music, it affects other areas of your learning. So they've discovered, the person next week is going to be talking about children, guitar in the classroom, teaching kids to play music and stuff. It helps their learning skill set, the dexterity from the fingers, the ear training, which is very important.
And how it relates to math, yes, absolutely.
If you can hear it, you can play it, but also that ear training, it helps them in all of their educational processes. And I think that's vital. And also, too, for adults, you got to learn to listen. And yeah. We'll learn if you don't listen. But I think that's really important. And when I was in school at SC, I studied with Duke Miller, was really, really into that. And he discovered that, like, the earlier you start your kids, the longer they retain the capability of learning. So, like, they did a study with Rachmaninoff, and they discovered that even at 70 or 80, he could learn a new piece. Which most people, when you get older, you can't learn that. It's harder to learn. So there was all this stuff.
Yeah, but he didn't have to negotiate a whammy bar.
There you go. But it's important. And I think that what you're doing with Make a Noise, and with Vi Academy, that's important because you're teaching people. It's those skill sets are important beyond the guitar. Mm. And I think that's, now we're out of time. I knew we would run out of time, and we didn't get to talk about the most important thing, which was the beekeeping, which I think is totally cool. But anyway, I just want to thank you. I want to mention really quick, www.vi.com, makeanoise.org, and viacademy.com. All three of those, check them out, and they just finished the 2015 thing just the beginning of the month for the Academy, so they're going to have a new one coming up in 2016. Make a Noise if you can help. It's really important. Get those instruments to those kids. That's a really big deal.
It's really cool of you, Jeff.
And I thank you. I thank you so much for doing that. And I, again, thank Jim Crockett for putting us together. He's an amazing guy, and he's really into the whole educational aspect.
I know.
JP, give me your information for Incendio, all that stuff real quick.
IncendioBand.com, Facebook.com/IncendioBand.
Okay. Anyway, thank you again. It's a real honor to have you on the show. And I'm going to play this this clip. It's the end of Whispering a Prayer. It's just listen to the instrument, the voice, the whole style. It's you. It's so unique. It's just great. So everybody have a great week. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next week.